This is Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Forget about Eat, Pray, Love. What about Fat, Sugar, Salt? That's the book by investigative reporter Michael Moss, who uncovers how the food industry is making fools of us all. From there, we talk to another enterprising journalist who has made food his beef. That's Michael Pollan. In his latest book, he breaks down why home cooking is key to healthy eating.
When it comes to eating, sometimes what you eat isn't as important as how you eat it. Behavioral economist Michael Norton explains why our food rituals can actually make our food taste better. And we top off the show with a man who's fixated not so much on pizza, but the cardboard box the pizza comes in. He's even written a book about it. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. Today we're playing a collection of conversations we've had over the year about eating, drinking, and tradition. We begin with a look at how the food industry is making fools of us all. You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. I have a feeling you might want to call in here too at 877-301-8970. A few years ago, there was Eat, Pray, Love. Now, and not quite the sequel, there's Salt, Sugar, Fat. It's written by Pulitzer Prize winner Michael Moss. He goes inside the processed food industry, and the picture is not pretty. Welcome to Boston Public Radio, Michael Moss.
Hi, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So before you tell us about what you found out in your book, and I have to say I'm appalled, I want to know, are you the real deal, Michael Moss? What did you just have for lunch?
I just had, believe it or not, a cheese sandwich
because
I am like hooked on cheese like the entire country. And I think you probably already know that, you know, our average consumption of cheese has tripled since the 70s to, get this, 33 pounds a person per year.
You're a good American, Michael. So what kind of bread, what kind of cheese?
Well, it was actually – so it was whole grain bread,
okay.
And it was Swiss and whatever else was in my cheese drawer because I got a whole bunch of cheese in there I can pull from. So – but the point is, and this is important, cheese is not bad. A certain amount of cheese that you eat for itself, the issue with obesity and the issue with our tripling of consumption is how the industry with the government hand in hand turned cheese into an ingredient that gets put into processed foods, stuffed into pizza crusts, and on and on and on. So we're not even really realizing we're eating the cheese. We're getting what the industry calls the mouthfeel of the cheese, which is basically saturated fat. And that is one of the three big allures that they have.
You know, one of the all of us who know only from experience as opposed to research and investigation like you've done, we all say things like we know the processed food is addictive. Is it figuratively addictive, or is it created so that it is literally addictive, Michael Moss?
You know, the industry, there is no word that the industry hates more than the word addiction. It loves alluring, craveable. There's all kinds of euphemisms. And I have to say that I was fairly skeptical until I spent some time with Nora Volkow, who runs the National Institute on Drug Abuse out of Washington, Bethesda, actually. And she convinced me, and she's a neuroscientist, and she's done studies on both narcotics and food. And she convinced me that her work shows that the most highly loaded fat and sugary foods, for some people, are every bit as addictive as some narcotics. I think for the rest of us, you can, you know, addiction may be too strong. Usually compelling, especially when you have stressful lives and another reason why we've become so dependent on convenience foods, processed foods.
We're speaking to Michael Moss. He's written this spectacular and frightening book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Our number is 877-301-8970.
Michael, tell people, because I was stunned by this. You talk about in your book how these great, you know, the people from Kraft Foods and all the big food makers get together. And, well, they don't do it together. They do it with their own people. But they're basically plotting on how to addict us. How do they do that?
So everything that goes into their formulation and making of products is to make them as attractive as possible. And you have to realize the companies argue rather convincingly that they never intended to make America obese or otherwise ill. It wouldn't be in their financial interest to do that. And moreover, any single one of their products can't be blamed for the obesity crisis, even the most sugary soda. But in, you know, through the documents that I was able to find, thousands and thousands of confidential documents, and the interviews that I was able to have with their top scientists, it's absolutely amazing to see how much effort they put into making these products as alluring as possible. And salt, sugar, fat are their three pillars, their holy grail, if you will. And their research shows that when they hit the perfect amounts of each of those ingredients, they'll send us over the moon. Their products will fly off the shelves. We'll eat more. We'll buy more. There being companies, they, of course, will make more money.
And by the way, didn't I read that they actually, things like the shape of salt on a particular food is something they study so that its exchange with your saliva produces a reaction that's more alluring, to use their word. Am I not right about that?
I used to think salt was just a rock came out of the ground and they ground it up a bit and you sprinkled it on food. Well, there are dozens of different varieties that they manipulate to fit perfectly with whatever processed food they're working on. And one of my favorites, and I use this at home, it's called kosher salt.
So do I.
Is, you know, looks like snow. It's actually tiny little pyramids with flat sides that stick better to the food. But here's the great thing. They're hollowed out inside, so the saliva has more contact with the salt, which sends the signals to your taste buds faster, which go right to the brain and say, hey, Michael, let's eat some more. They call it the flavor burst of salt.
What's another
salt? Oh, my God. We'll have to go home and take the kosher salt and look at it under a microscope because I have it, too. I never noticed it was flat and pyramid
fascinating.
Shape.
Fascinating.
Is this bliss point that you talk about in your book?
The bliss point actually applies more to sugar than anything else. And a legend in the industry, Howard Moskowitz, walked me through his recent creation of a new soda for Dr. Pepper, a new soda flavor. And to do that, and he's a mathematician trained in experimental psychology at Harvard as well. And to do that, he uses, you know, regression analysis, incredible amounts of math and science. He'll take dozens and dozens of formulas slightly varying from one to the other and then have consumers test those. And he'll take all of the data, throw it into his computer to find the very perfect amount of sugar that will guarantee success for that soda, particular soda. And you have to remember that there's a certain limit to our salt, to our sugar fondness. You can do your own experiment, take a cup of coffee if you like sugar in it, and keep adding sugar until it hits the optimum level. Then keep adding more, and you'll like it less. And so the bliss point is a bell-shaped curve, the top of the curve, where your liking, your loving, your craving of sugar is at the very top. And for products aimed at kids, they used kids as the guinea pigs because their sweet tooth is actually even stronger than ours.
I think I've lived my whole life at the bliss point, Michael Moss. Hey, Michael, before we take calls, did these people eat their own food? I mean, you talk to casino operators, and Massachusetts is about to begin a casino experiment, and you say, do you want a casino in your hometown? They go, absolutely not. Do these guys eat, or women eat their own stuff?
That was actually one of the surprising things, is that so many of the top people I talked to at these companies do not eat their own food, especially when they run into health problems. There was a top scientist, now former at Kraft, who blew out his knee, and so he couldn't jog anymore as his way of weight control. First thing he did was stop eating any calories in liquids, because he knows there's actually some really intriguing science that says that when we ingest calories in liquids, our brains are less able to detect those calories than they are in solid food. And then he stopped eating things like salty snacks, because he's one of those many of us who open a bag of chips and cannot stop with the one little serving that they talk about in fine print on the package.
Oh, yeah. Who can stop with the one little serving? If you have a big bag of potato chips, you're going to go through the whole thing. What are, Michael, the the foods that they have achieved this perfect combination of sugar, salt, and fat that people find irresistible. Can you name me a few?
Well, you just said the perfect one, which is the potato chip. And we all know that salt is there, and that hits your tongue first, the flavor bit burst. It's got it's loaded with fat, and the mouthfeel of fat gives it the crunch and this that wonderful warm feeling.
Great.
But it turns out that the potato chip is actually loaded with sugar, not added to the chip, but in the form of the starch of the potato itself, which gets converted to sugar the second that it hits your tongue. So it's got all three: salt, sugar, fat. And there's something more too. If you like Cheetos,
yes,
the industry has these great insider terms about the things that they do to these products to make them so alluring. And for Cheetos, there's this one of the 12 things that makes Cheetos just a miracle food in their eyes. It has something called vanishing caloric density. When the Cheetos melt in your mouth, the signal goes to your brain that, hey, the calories have disappeared. No problem, Michael. Just keep eating. You might as well be eating celery.
Well, you know what they've also done brilliantly with Cheetos is they've created an orange dye that never washes off your hands. So you're constantly reminded to go back. Let's go to the phones.
Hold on for 1 second. Michael, I just have to tell you, you've got one of the great voices of all time. I just love listening to you.
You know, memory is so important. I went to the Kellogg Research Development Factory. They were trying to prove to me how dependent they were on salt. And boy, they did a great job because they made for me some of their iconic foods without any salt in them at all, including Cheez-Its, which I can normally eat day in and day out. It was the most god-awful experience you ever. But I mention this because they had some Pop-Tarts that they were making, and they'd screwed up, and they were all kind of going in this big vat, and they were going to dispose of it. But it brought me back. The smell brought me back to my childhood because I was a bit of a latchkey kid for a time and grew up on Pop-Tarts. And it's funny how your memory really counts for a lot.
It does.
In processed foods.
I lived inside a bag of potato chips when I was a latchkey kid. George from New Bedford, you were on Boston Public Radio, 877-301-8970, with Michael Moss, the author of Salt, Sugar, and Fat. Welcome, George.
Well, thank you very much. Michael, I believe I've heard on a recent radio program that there's a upper level for, restricting the amount of daily intake of sugar to 44 grams. I don't know if that's true or not. But how many grams would be in a teaspoon of sugar anyway?
Well, it's going to be about 4.2, 4.5. It depends how much, it's a little inaccurate the way you measure it. Here's the deal on sugar. The FDA, which normally sets standards for how much ideally we should be taking, is totally shied away from sugar. So when you look on the nutrient facts box on every label and look under the line of sugar, they'll tell you how much sugar is in the product, but they won't tell you what your daily max recommended amount should be because they haven't set that limit. And moreover, they don't even tell you how much sugar is added to the product. It's one issue that consumer health advocates are going nuts about and pushing Washington to do something better on. The American Heart Association has come up with some numbers like 44 grams. It depends how old you are, male, female, your other sort of health conditions. There's a sliding scale, but I would refer you to them if you want to get a number for yourself.
George, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
We're talking to Michael Moss, author of the absolutely fascinating new book, Salt, Sugar, and Fat. Our numbers are 877-301-8970 if you'd like to talk to us and or Michael. And also our email address is bpr@wgbh.org. You know, I had no idea that products like Prego spaghetti sauce or Yoplait were so loaded with sugar. Or if you look at the ingredients in breads, like you think are pretty good breads, Pepperidge Farm breads or something, they've got like high fructose corn syrup. Who knew? I mean, I didn't know. This is all to make me reach the bliss point when I toast my bread.
Absolutely. And it used to be. And that's one of the things I think that really startles even food industry scientists is how sugar moved from from desserts and ice cream throughout the grocery store. And you mentioned Prego, its sauces can have as much as 2 teaspoons of sugar in a serving, which is as much as a couple of Oreo, the equivalent of a couple of Oreo cookies. Now, some of that's going to be from the tomatoes, but it's much more than some other sauces you can get, and certainly much more than you would make at home, typically.
You know, we're talking to Michael Moss, who is the author of Salt, Sugar, Fat. In a second, Michael, after we take a few more calls, I know we're the second fattest nation on Earth. We used to be the fattest, but Qatar is finally...
That's right. I
want to talk to you about solutions, and for people who resist government intervention, whether or not the Michael Bloombergs of the world have the right idea. But first, let's go to Megan is in Brookline, and she's on with, as we just said, with Michael Moss. Welcome, Megan.
Hi, thank you.
Pleasure.
I'm just wondering if high fructose corn syrup is as evil as Whole Foods says it is, and what exactly is it, and are the corn lobbyists knowingly just making sure that high fructose corn syrup is in all of our foods as a money-making, venture.
All great questions, Megan.
You know, I love this battle between table, you know, the cane and sugar beet growers for table sugar and the high fructose corn syrup growers, and now you have fruit. And I'll get to that in a second. The nutrition experts I trust the most say that sugar is sugar is sugar from a caloric standpoint. And there's almost no difference that they can see in the science so far between table sugar, high fructose corn syrup, and mind you, fruit juice. And that's why nurses in schools are no longer pushing juice on kids who are overweight. They're pushing plain water on them. And yet, I mean, one of the interesting things about fruit is you're seeing fruit splashed on the label of products, you know, so much more in the grocery store. And often they'll just be a smidgen of fruit concentrate in there, which can be nothing more than plain sugar, for its halo of health. So fruit juice, even high fructose corn syrup, table sugar, it's all the same to nutritionists who are worried about calories.
Megan, thank you so much for the call. Let's talk about solutions for a minute. You know, some people say education is the cure. Read books like Michael's and have people like Michelle Obama talking about what are healthy foods, what are not healthy foods. It seems to me, as a formerly overweight kid myself and as a parent, parents in this country have totally failed their children. Well, I mean, you have all these statistics. And so I am one who leans in the direction of the Michael Bloombergs with the soda size and the salt bans potentially, because we have proven that we can't do it ourselves. Yes,
well,
no?
Yeah, well, certainly one thing that failed was the school system. We used to have home economists who would teach not just girls but boys how to shop, how to cook, how to be in control of food in their life. And that fell by the wayside. At the same time, I read in the book that the industry began glomming onto the home economist movement. Betty Crocker, I used to think she was a real person. She was a figment of the imagination of a marketing official.
She wasn't real?
No, she wasn't real. She started out sort of writing these letters to customers, but then she started out sort of championing home economics. But in her vein, it was getting people to eat more foods available in the grocery store, including processed foods, convenience foods. So I'm actually really sympathetic, and I've heard this from the White House. They're looking at reinvigorating the home economics program. I know with my own two boys, 8 and 13, if you just, you know, we found that we've just talked to them a little bit about food. They're not going to throw those carrots and apple slices away in the lunchroom that they might otherwise. Kids really get it. They just need like a little bit of information and engagement, and it goes a long way. So I think that's one thing that could be really useful. You mentioned other government intervention. I mean, the problem is there's already tons of government intervention. The subsidies that go into the highly processed foods are huge. And part of another thing I know the White House is thinking about doing is just to figure out a way to shift some of those subsidies from the highly processed foods to the things that everybody says we should be eating more of, but they cost more, the fresh fruits and vegetables.
Our number
that
is,
could be a really key thing.
Excuse me, Michael. Our number is 877-301-8970 if you want to call in and talk to Michael, who is the author of Salt, Sugar, and Fat. Michael, tell the story to our listeners about Lunchables, how Lunchables came to be.
Lunchables was invented in the 80s when the company that owned it, Oscar Mayer, was starting to run into a bit of trouble on red meat. People were eating less because of the saturated fat and salt. They brought together their most brilliant marketers and package designers. And I spent a bunch of time with a great guy named Bob Drain, who worked at Oscar Mayer. He was fighting to save jobs at Oscar Mayer. And also just being a pure scientist became enthralled by this project. And he and his team created the cold, pre-assembled, ready-to-eat lunch tray called the Lunchables, which, as we know, over the years, and this was after his time on the project, morphed into things like pizza Lunchables and hot dog Lunchables, hamburger Lunchables, pancake Lunchables, the maxed out Lunchables, which would wipe out a whole, almost a whole day's maximums for kids on fat, salt, sugar, became a huge marketing thing. In part because of the psychology that the company applied to the product, especially for kids. It wasn't so much about food, one Kraft official was fond of saying. It was about empowerment. And they came up with this slogan, you know, all day for kids, all day you do what they say, all day you got to do what they say, but lunchtime is all yours. And that struck a note with American kids. And the other thing about the Lunchables, it brought fast food into the grocery store. It was a gateway product. And so you saw more and more things in the store that really resembled things you used to buy at fast food chains.
Let's go to John from Nashua. John, you're on with the author of Sugar, Salt, and Fat, Michael Moss. Salt, Sugar, and Fat. Whoops.
Hi, John.
Hi. Two questions. Real quick, I'd like to know your opinion on the Atkins diet of a low carb, and can you define what a sugar alcohol is?
We're losing you, John. John, we're going to put you on hold, see if we can get you back in a minute. The question that we were able to hear, Michael Moss, what's with the Atkins diet, which I thought is sort of out of vogue. It was big, what, in the 80s, early 90s or something?
Yeah,
what's the deal now?
You know, the latest front page in the New York Times is the Mediterranean diet,
yeah,
which is my own personal one. I mean, I can eat olive oil and olives and cheese and bread and the red wine forever and ever. You know, I shy away from that in the book. There's one thing that really grabbed me, though, and I have to say Walter Willett, the head of nutrition at Harvard,
yeah,
convinced me of this, as other people. He is totally into nuts, like cashews. I mean, if anything has sort of a miracle property, because you can take a handful of nuts, and if you're careful not to overeat because they're loaded with calories, they will fill you up until it's dinner time and
really
give you great protein and give you good, you know, a good balance of fats, because all fat is not bad. You need to have the good fats and less of the saturated. So that's the only thing in my book that I sort of, you know, at all sort of mention in terms of a dieting thing. I think there's really something there with nuts.
Can we get one hopeful note? I hope I get the company right. If not, you'll correct me. We're talking to Michael Moss, author of Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Is it Kraft that actually started policing itself and creating healthier,
yes,
foods? It is Kraft. Why did they do that? Because they thought it was in their economic self-interest? Because they had a come-to-Jesus moment? What happened with Kraft?
I'm so glad you mentioned it. They had a cabal of insiders who sincerely became concerned about the obesity crisis. And so much about it, what I read about the book is that the industry itself has known for years that responsibility for the crisis lays at least in large part at their feet. And Kraft, starting in around 2003, said, we've got to do something here. We're going to strike out on our own. They brought in some obesity experts, health nutrition experts. They cut back on their marketing of sugary products to kids. They looked at their disclosures on packages and started telling people how many total calories were in the package and how much total saturated fat, et cetera. And then they did the most amazing thing. They looked at their formulas and they told their food engineers to – they had to put a cap on the amount of salt, sugar, fat they were putting on project, which was just stunning to their people, because all of their history, they have driven to use as much of those ingredients as they possibly could. And Kraft said, no, we've got to stop here and do the right thing by consumers. And hats off to them for giving that a go.
But Michael, it's also smart business in some sense, because they have to know that salt, sugar, and fat in the fat Americans is becoming like the cigarette issue, because the healthcare costs from obesity now are rivaling, if not surpassing, the healthcare costs of cigarette smoking. So they're going to be in trouble financially if they don't make some modifications, are they not?
Absolutely. And I think Kraft recognized that. If you want to talk about sort of the way out of this, it's, you know, it's got to be public concern, growing public concern about what we put into our bodies, getting to these companies, you know, so that they know that the way to make money is to make more healthy foods.
Okay.
And the way to keep the public trust is to do that.
Michael Moss, we only have 30 seconds left. Other than Kraft, this has been the most depressing conversation I've had in years. So give us a hopeful...
What do you mean? The bliss point?
Give us a
hopeful potato chips
sign for the future in the next 30 seconds. Tell us why we're going to solve this salt, sugar, and fat epidemic.
In the very short term, you can read this book and I'm hoping it will empower you to walk into the grocery store and do just a few things that will let you get out with your good health intact. For example, the most loaded stuff tends to be at eye level. Simple trick, just look low, look high, and you'll find, for instance, the cereals with less sugar in them. Just simple things like that, I think, can be really empowering to consumers.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Michael Moss. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times. His latest book is Fat, Sugar, Salt: How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Up next, we're going to talk about dumplings. What makes a great dumpling? Where in Greater Boston you can get them, and why is it that every culture has its own variation on this stuffed, doughy mound of goodness? That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. A couple of months ago, NPR decided to have a dumpling week. We had to do our part to observe the occasion, which we did by inviting Lily Jan on the show to talk about what makes a dumpling a dumpling. Lily Jan is a chef instructor, a culinary anthropologist, and a dumpling aficionado. Welcome, Lily Jan. It's nice to see you, Lily.
Thank you.
So, Lily, thank you for being here. We all know about dumplings. I mean, I think of dumplings, Peking raviolis. I didn't know till today that Joyce Chan, the famous restaurateur and chef, came up with that name for Peking raviolis, the great little appetizers that are dumplings. But now I understand there's all sorts of different kinds of dumplings and varieties of dumplings and a specific thing that defines a dumpling. So I think we have to start at the beginning here. What is a dumpling, please?
I think a dumpling is a really personally defined item. Uh-huh. In my world, I think a dumpling is something stuffed in a dough. It can't be bigger than the size of about your hand.
Okay.
And it needs to be snackable. It needs to be something that won't necessarily make you commit to an entire meal, but could be a meal if you wanted it to. But it needs to be snacky and a side dish.
You know, when you say a side dish, and you mentioned, Marjorie just mentioned Joyce Chen, who I had the privilege, as a lot of us did, to meet when she was alive and
Absolutely.
Owning that wonderful restaurant out there near a fresh pond. My recollection was, you know, 20 plus years ago, as Marty said, Peking ravioli was an appetizer. That's what you picked. And you generally had it with a meal, particularly if you had kids. When did the explosion of the dumpling in American food happen? Well, there's an obsession with dumplings now that goes well beyond just the appetizer, right?
I agree. And I think part of it, though, is that they are immensely customizable. I think that people are becoming more comfortable with the idea of dumplings and seeing them in different cultures and cuisines. So, you know, the Nepalese have a dumpling-esque item, which is called momos.
What is that?
It's like a dumpling. It's just a little heartier because it's colder.
Mm-hmm. What's it stuffed with?
It's stuffed with meat and, you know, variety of spices and flavors, just like a normal Chinese dumpling.
Okay.
They just call it momos. And, you know, the Japanese have gyoza. So there's no shortage of dumplings around the world and in different cuisines. And I think as people have become more adventurous culinarily and, you know, people kind of cross boundaries and fusion foods have come into play, people are becoming more comfortable with dumplings and trying them more. And you know, China's opened up a lot. And so a lot of the chefs in China have come to the U.S. and gone overseas to open dumpling places. So you can see a larger variety.
But Lily, based on your definition at the beginning of this, we're talking to Lily Jen, who is the aficionado in chief of dumplings. And my two kids are Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
However, they love Indian food.
Mm-hmm.
Samosa mm-hmm. is a dough-wrapped, snackable,
yeah.
hand-sized. Is that a dumpling, according
it's
to you?
It's totally a dumpling.
Oh, it is. Okay.
And I think, you know, but a lot of people think, oh, well, that's one of the examples. But Indian cuisine has tons of sweet dumplings as well.
Mm, that's a great
and
point.
And people often think that dumplings can only be savory. But actually, even within Chinese culture, we have sweet dumplings. We have something called tang yuan, which is eaten normally around Chinese New Year. And it's round and it's stuffed with a different kind of dough. It's made out of rice flour. It's like mochi. And inside they put red bean paste or sesame paste or black sesame paste. And it's delicious. And it's very good luck. So, you know, there are lots of different styles of dumplings. And I think that that's part of the reason they've become so popular. And I think part of the customizableness is also why. Because if you're gluten intolerant, if you are vegetarian, if you eschew certain products, there's a dumpling out there for you.
Yeah.
Dumplings
are us. So where do we go? Can we talk about where you go to get great
dumplings?
Of course.
I have a nominee or two. And by the way, we can ask people at 877-301-8970 if you have dumpling questions or you want to say what your favorite dumpling is or if you want to nominate a place is the best place to go for any kind of dumplings, give us a buzz, 877-301-8970.
And I want to ask you about the best place you think are some good places around town to get dumplings. But also, you know, when you do get the Peking raviolis, mm-hmm. you can get them pan-fried or you can get them steamed. It doesn't really matter, does it?
It doesn't, except if you're watching your waistline, I would
yeah,
say.
Yeah, okay. All right.
You can even get them deep-fried, which is really edging on dangerous. But, you know, pan-fried and steamed and boiled are all really commonly found yeah. all over Asia for all dumpling preparations.
So is there a place you can go like you just have a dumpling meal from
yes.
beginning to end?
Absolutely.
Can I nominate one?
Absolutely.
Gourmet Dumpling House in yeah. Chinatown is one of the most extraordinary restaurants on the planet. Am I right or am I right?
Write that down.
Funnily enough, I actually prefer their main dishes over their
really?
Dumplings. But that's not to say that their dumplings aren't great. Their Shandong-style pan-fried dumplings are great. And Shandong-style dumplings is a particular style. And part of the reason these all have different names and things is because of the region that they're from. And dumplings also get named after what they're filled with, how they're folded, how they're cooked. And they also have fanciful names, some of them. You know, the Chinese poets had fun in the days. But I think the Shandong ones at Gourmet Dumpling House are great. I think if you're looking for the Shanghainese soup dumplings that really kind of exploded all over the culinary scene in New York in the mid to early 90s, the Dumpling Cafe in Chinatown, just down the street, is also really great. You know, one of the characteristics of a really good Chinese soup dumpling is that the skin, the wrapper, is very, very thin.
Yep.
But and you can kind of not understand the physics of how it's suspending all of the things inside. And I think they do a very successful version of that.
So you just mentioned that some of the Chinese poets had fun naming the dumplings. Are there some poetically named dumplings that we should know about?
I think a lot of people wouldn't know that the wonton, as clunky as it sounds in English, is
that's a poem?
No, it's actually the name wonton literally translates to swallowing clouds.
Ooh.
So you
how
should be eating
that?
These wonderfully fluffy and light, gorgeously, you know, silken wontons.
Yeah.
What often comes across is not always true, but, you know, execution sometimes leaves a lot to be desired.
Hey, Lily Jen, before we get to the calls at 877-301-8970, what's the oddest thing that you've ever eaten inside a dough that you've called a dumpling?
Well, I've seen some interesting takes on the traditional Chinese dumplings. I've had a foie dumpling.
As in foie gras?
Yes. It was unnecessarily decadent, in my personal opinion. It was very much like gilding the lily, excuse me. It was just too much. And then there was also a black truffle one, which was really just so many things going on. I was very confused. My palate was, am I Italian? Am I, you know, I didn't really enjoy those. So those are some crazier things. But I've had some nice ones, like mealworms actually make a pretty decent filling.
Oh,
I'm afraid to ask, what are mealworms exactly?
Just like maggots? I know that people are eating lunch right now. I feel bad for saying
this.
Well,
I'm glad you brought it up, yeah. But wait a second. They're alive inside the dumpling
no,
or they've passed on?
They're done and they're stir-fried, so they're a bit crispy on the inside.
Oh, yeah. Well, I can deal with that.
And
protein.
And stir-fried with some chili
protein.
And some tofu.
And what about dumpling places outside of Chinatown, though, that aren't Chinese?
That aren't Chinese?
Yeah. Are there any, like, dumpling restaurants beyond the Chinese cuisine?
Arguably, I think pupusas kind of walk the line. I think pupusas could technically be considered a dumpling because they're not always very big.
What are those?
They're an El Salvadorian, they're like a corn tortilla stuffed with things, sometimes cheese, sometimes eggs. Some people would call them a sandwich, but I don't think they're a sandwich because you don't actually split them open. And they can be sealed entirely. So there's some great places. I think there's a great place in Austin called Habanero that does pupusas that I think are pretty tasty. There is Punjab Palace in Austin as well that does some nice samosas, as does India Quality. And actually, there's a random Pakistani deli in Mansfield, Mass., which I know is completely bizarre. That has the best samosas I've ever had in my
life. Really?
What's it called?
I can't for the life of me remember.
One of our people will look up what the name is. One last thing before we get to the calls. I'm thinking about the possibilities as you're speaking, Lily Jen.
I'm hungry.
A knish is a dumpling, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, of course.
And pierogies.
And so you added a criterion here, which is you don't open it up. I mean, you started with it's wrapped in dough. It's snackable, or not quite bite-sized, but a snackable size. But also, the fact that you don't open it, like a sandwich, is another criterion, right?
Right. Like, I don't think you should be able to deconstruct your dumpling.
Dumpling, yeah.
You know, I mean, there are some dumplings that are never totally sealed, like the shumai at dim sum. It's an open-top dumpling. But you don't take it apart so that you can eat the skin separately from the filling. That would defeat the entire purpose. It comes as a package.
Know why NPR named this Dumpling Week. Every week should be Dumpling Week.
877-301-8970. Is our number if you want to call with your dumpling questions or tell us where great places are to get dumplings. Let's go to Tim from Canton. Hi, Tim.
Hey, how's it going?
Great.
Excellent.
So I want to bring up the Polish dumpling, the pierogi.
Oh, yes.
So there's a place down in Fall River called Patty's Pierogies, and it's absolutely amazing. They're actually featured on, what's that show, Drive-Ins, Diners, and Dives.
Oh, yeah.
Wait a second. This is your Marjorie's hometown.
No,
you've
I've
never
heard of it.
Been there?
I've heard of it. Well, I don't get down to that much anymore, but I've heard of it. Patty's Pierogies.
They go outside the traditional Polish pierogi, and they have an Italian pierogi. They have, they have pierogies for dogs there. It's absolutely amazing.
Hey, Tim, in the traditional Polish pierogi, what's the filling? What's the most?
I've had it with cabbage. I've had it with cheese and sausage. It's just, and I've had it with cabbage and cheese. It's normally, that's pretty much it.
They used to have a place.
Tim, thank you for the contribution.
In my hometown, Fall River, called the Ukrainian Club, and that's what they served Ukrainian food. They served pierogies, even though those are Polish, I think, right? But they served them at the Uke Club, as we used to call it.
I think they're Polish. I mean, the Ukrainians have another one that I can't pronounce, so I'm going to butcher it, but I think they're called Vereniki. Something, but they look very similar to a pierogi.
They're really good.
And they're also stuffed with this creamy mashed potato-y cheese filling. It is, I mean, pierogies on a day like today where it's a bit cold and damp out are possibly the greatest thing on earth.
So where's a close place to Boston?
I think actually I've been to Patty's Pierogies in Fall River and they're,
it's really
worth
good?
The drive.
Okay.
Where
did
the dumpling thing happen with you? Why did you decide this was part of who you are?
So I'm a second career person, and I became a chef later after I realized that PR wasn't for me. And I just kind of embraced my culture. And a big part of my culture, especially within my family's culture, was dumplings. There are photos of me as a child folding dumplings with my grandmother.
Oh, that is great.
And, you know, it's something that my family likes to joke about a lot, but I love dumplings, and it's become kind of a joke within my friends and my families, and it's what I've been known for. I've made instructional videos, and my friend even featured on her blog a dumpling-shaped pillow.
Oh, my
that
gosh.
That I now own two of, because they're amazing.
Well, you know, I was going to ask you about cooking them. It's not that hard, right? You just have to know how to fold them.
It's not. Yeah, it's really not that hard. And even folding them, if you don't mind something that's less than aesthetically pleasing,
right. It's
not that bad. It's, you know, boiling something is pretty simple. You just need to be able to boil water and make a sauce. And
right. The
sauce is totally objective. And you can steam them, which is pretty easy, but you have to have the right equipment. But pan frying them is really simple. I mean, all most people do is either you can boil them first and then just put them in a hot skillet, which is what people often do with pierogies, just to get that kind of fat flavor infused. And in pierogies, it's often Polish sausage or bratwurst or something. But I also like to pan fry them. So I fry them in the pan so the bottoms get crispy, get that nice brown color, and then I fill the pan with a little bit of water, cover it so it steams the rest of the way through.
Oh.
And then by the time the water's gone, the bottom re-crisps, and so you get these wonderful crispy-bottomed pot stickers that don't feel gummy.
You know, Lily Jane, you mentioned the photos of you with your kid, with your grandmother making dumplings. One of the great scenes is if you're lucky enough to be able to go into the back of a Chinese restaurant, mm-hmm. particularly a family-owned Chinese restaurant, and you'll see older people back there not just making dumplings, making thousands of dumplings. Their counters filled with the dough. I guess they sort of wet the thing a little bit, drop the stuffing right in. It's really a beautiful scene.
It becomes like a family tradition. My mom, whenever I grew up in Hong Kong, and when I moved to the U.S., she would come and visit. And when she would come to visit, she would make dumplings and stock my freezer with them. And we would sit around. We'd get all the filling and all the wrappers ready with all of the little dipping bowls for the water for sealing it. And we'd put on Oprah, which is perhaps the not Asian part of it. But we would sit and we'd watch Oprah. And in an episode of Oprah, we would be able to fold and pleat and finish about 400 dumplings.
Well, before we go back to the coals, you just mentioned that frozen dumplings. Yep. There's a big debate about whether or not that passes the test. Where are you on that?
My frozen dumplings are great.
Yeah.
I think there are some really great store-bought brands, but you really, you know, your mileage may vary.
You know where they make them homemade? Since there's a place called Wong's in Somerville. You ever been there on Broadway?
Oh, no.
Where they make them, and they sell them in packs of about 65.
Oh.
And they are affordable and really, really great. 877-301-8970. Lily Jan is sitting in with us, and let's go to Annette. You're in the car. You're on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Annette.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm almost embarrassed to be thinking this is the first call I've ever made on radio.
Dumplings are compelling.
There's a wise choice, Annette. Go ahead.
Literally, I totally feel your affection for the dumpling. I love the idea of the pillow. And I think what always brings passion to my heart is the baked bao, okay, with the char siu pork. Mm-hmm. I just love it when it's baked and it's golden and the egg white has gone over it. And as a child growing up, having a baked bao was the greatest thing I waited for with my aunt, who just recently passed away, and I think maybe that's why I'm calling. It was the thing she would pack me up for college, send me off with a dozen baked baos from a restaurant in Maryland. And then when I found Hei La Moon and on Beach Street, I discovered, again, a really good baked bao.
Bao is another word for dumpling, we should say, right? Am I wrong?
It gets a little controversial at this point. It's a dough, for sure, but it's a rising dough, so there's definitely some kind of leavening going on, and it's fluffier. So it could be considered a dumpling in that it is a carb-wrapped filling, and it's about that size of your hand. But bao, in Chinese culture at least, has a very different designation.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Annette, that was a great, great, great first call, and you made a wise choice. I hope you'll call us again soon. Thanks so much.
You know, we got an email from Anne, who knows that you're Jewish, Jim, and
yes,
she wants to know about the kreplach?
Kreplach.
Yeah, I mean, that's a variation on a theme. Yeah,
absolutely.
They are. I mean, I never thought about dumplings other than being dumplings until you came in today, but they really are all variations on a theme. Let's go back to the calls. Erica, you're in Billerica. You're on with Lily Jen. Hey there, Erica.
Hi.
I
think you're all thinking a little too small. There needs to be a national chain of International House of Dumplings. Where, I mean, these days the tapas and the small plates restaurants are all the rage. You need to be able to go into one restaurant and to be able to get little plates, and you can get a pupusa and a knish and a ravioli and a kreplach, etc., all in one place.
Well,
I wish somebody would open one of those.
Eric, I can say I've been to such a place in Chicago, and the place in Chicago, the name of which escapes me at the moment, and they are bao, I guess, which is slightly different. They have, not only they have all the international flavors like you're just describing, Lily was describing, they have eggs and sausage inside a bao. They have chocolate inside a bao. They have coconut. And so the answer is some people are onto that, and boy, would that be great in Boston. Is there such a place in this part of the world?
Not for International House of Bao or dumpling per se. I mean, you can certainly get a good variety of dumplings if you go to Dim Sum in Chinatown
or
Hei La Moon, as you know, a caller mentioned. That's a great place for dim sum. And there's lots of different places that offer a variety of dumplings on the menu, like Jojo Taipei in Austin as well. I actually thought about opening up a dumpling cart in Boston, but I did the math, and the labor that it would take is not really worth the trade-off. But it is a really labor-intensive thing. So I wish somebody would come up with it. I just wish that they weren't me. So I like napping.
Let's take one more call. Erica and Bell Ricka, thanks for calling.
Oh, Erica was just who we spoke to.
Oh, Erica's the person we spoke to. Yeah. Oops, John from Worcester then. Hi, John. From Worcester.
Oh, hey, what's going on?
What's going on with you?
Take my call. Nothing, and welcome back. It's good to have everybody back in the room here.
We're all happy to be here. Thanks, John. What's up?
Okay, so I've got an alternate dumpling here. I was totally inspired with this conversation. Thank you, Lily. And I wanted to share my favorite dumpling in the world. I didn't know it was a dumpling, but by your definition, it is. If you ever go to a Brazilian, not the Brazilian restaurant where they serve all the meat, but the bakery,
yeah.
Oh, my God, they have a thing called a coxinha, okay? And the coxinha is, Lily, are you familiar with these?
I think so, yes.
But give us more on it, John. What are they like?
Okay, here's what it is. So get ready. It's this, like, soft corn dough. That's what it's wrapped in. It's sort of shaped like a large tear, maybe the size of a child's fist. And inside is all this shredded chicken with spices. And inside this deep-fried corn dough. And sometimes they put some cream cheese in there. Ugh.
John, what's it? Give us the name of this thing again so I can get one at about 2:15 today. What's it called?
It's a coxinha. COXINHA.
Great.
Coxinha.
Wow.
Hey, John, thanks. You know, we're going to take actually one more because Linda from Boston raises an issue that I'm dying to hear Lily Jen respond to. Linda, welcome to Boston Public Radio. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
So I think it's the sauce on the dumplings because often the dumplings are kind of uniform. They're good, but they're kind of the same in any restaurant you go to, but the sauce seems to make it.
How and about it? Is that like, I'm worried that Lily's going to say it violates the purity of the issue of the dumpling. Is that, am I close or no?
You know me so well. you know, honestly, I think a dumpling should be able to stand on its own. If you have dumplings in China, they don't generally aren't very sauced. They don't have a lot on them. They might have a little bit of soy sauce or a little bit of vinegar just to cut through the fat, but it's not a heavily sauced item. I do know that sauce can heighten a dumpling, though. You know, for example, the soup dumpling is always eaten with a black vinegar and thinly cut ginger, and it really enhances the flavor. Yeah. But it shouldn't make or break the dumpling. If it's making or breaking the dumpling, you need to find a better dumpling.
I knew that was going to be the answer, Linda, but thank you for the call.
So when you do eat the Peking ravioli, either pan-fried or boiled, or steamed rather, is it just soy sauce you should put on it?
Everybody has their own personal thing. Uh-huh. Mine is soy sauce, sesame oil, little bit of vinegar, and a lot of chilies.
Oh, that's great.
For people who are not maybe as adventurous, I think omitting that, the chilies at the end, and then maybe a little bit of sugar and some water will really replicate some of the sauces that I know that are really popular in dumpling houses.
Oh, man. There are three smiles in this room, I can tell you.
Lily,
that are...
you should have brought us 4 dozen dumplings, okay? You fell down on the job here.
Are you a great dumpling chef? We should have asked that. Are you?
I like to think I am.
Great. When are we coming over?
You know, the door's always open. I have 400 in my freezer right now.
Is that so?
It's true.
See you later this afternoon. Lily Jan, you're great. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Lily is a chef instructor, a culinary anthropologist, and as you have just heard, a dumpling aficionado. Lily, thanks again for joining us. Up next, writer Michael Pollan, the man who has been credited with leading the modern-day food movement to eat local, to eat healthy, and to keep it simple, has discovered the joys of cooking within his own kitchen. It's the subject of his latest book. He joins us next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, today we're replaying some of our favorite conversations we've had over the past year. We pick things up with journalist Michael Pollan. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is a man who has given us some simple directives when it comes to eating a healthy diet. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Now, for those of you who took this a step further to adopt the raw food diet, you can pull your oven mitt out of storage. Journalist Michael Pond's latest book is called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Michael, it's great to meet you.
Thanks, Jim. Good to be here.
Well, this is a great book. And I was just saying before we went on the air that I get criticized all the time by my children who read, my oldest daughter particularly, who reads all your books about everything I'm doing wrong when she comes home. But you talk about how we should get, that we should cook, that we shouldn't live our lives at the hot bar at Whole Foods or running down to a Trader Joe's, whatever it is. Why should we cook, Michael Pollan?
Well, it's the only way to take control of your diet. If you're having people prepare your food who are large industrial corporations who really don't, are not interested in your health, they're really interested in just selling you food, they're not going to cook as well as you can cook for yourself or loved ones can cook for you. So, the longer I looked at the whole question of nutrition and what we should be eating, I discovered to my surprise that it wasn't about finding the good or evil nutrient, that's a trap and doesn't really work. It really is the best predictor of a healthy diet is whether it was cooked by a human being or a big corporation.
You know, and you mentioned as a formerly round little child, which I was, as Marjorie knows, I've told many times, the connection, you cite a study, the connection to obesity here, and particularly child, is so direct. Causal connection is huge.
The parallels are, and in fact, this was determined by a Harvard economist, David Cutler, who looked at this, and he tracked the obesity epidemic to the decline in home cooking. And the two things are in lockstep, beginning around really 1980 or so. And the reason is that when you don't cook meals, people end up snacking and they end up eating food that's been engineered to get you to eat too much of it. I mean, you know, the food industry has a strong interest in getting you to eat more than you should. It's a tough industry. The margins are small. The population is growing at a not as high a rate as Wall Street wants these companies to grow. There is the fixed stomach. How much food can a human eat? And they work very hard to expand the fixed stomach and get us to eat more. So, and they do it by layering salt, fat, and sugar. And when you put these things together, food becomes really addictive.
Well, one of the things I think that some people think, especially moms and dads do cook more, but I think moms are mostly doing the cooking and you're working full time and
which
stuff.
Which is a problem, but we can get to that.
It is a problem, yeah. One of the things you try to do is, okay, I'm going to go to a bakery and buy really good bread that's not full of high fructose corn syrup, even if it's expensive, if I can afford to do it, which I do actually. I go buy this great bakery, or I'll go to like a Whole Foods where I think that there's not going to be so much junk in the foods and the meat's not going to be full of steroids and all these antibiotics and terrible things. But I'm buying it a lot of the time prepared to save time.
Mm.
And I thought that was a good thing. And you've burst my bubble, Michael Pollan.
You know, I think time is really what stands between a lot of people and their desire to cook.
Yeah.
Also, a loss of confidence and a sense
of not
having skills. And I think that's too bad because it's really not rocket science. I mean, we watch these cooking shows on television that makes it look really intimidating. Like, I can't cook like that. But the goal is not to make restaurant food at home. That's special occasion stuff. But I think we do feel pressed on time. However, I just encourage people to look at how they are spending their time. We find time for the things we deem important. And over the last 15 years, we've all found 2 hours in the day to surf the internet. Like, where did that come from? It's still a 24-hour day. Well, we took some from television. We decided that was more important. And my argument is that this is really important. There's nothing more important to your health, your family's health, or the social life of your family. Because if you cook, people will sit down together and have a meal and talk.
So wait a second. Come on, Michael Pollan. You're legendary. But if given the choice between watching The Good Wife, then watching Mad Men, and then having DVR'd Veep and watching that after, you'd actually cook something instead.
Game of Thrones, Jim.
No, that I'm not watching. You know, what stunned a lot of people when your book came out, and I was amongst them because we're all Michael Pollan adherents, is the fact that you were not a big-time cook is sort of stunning. I mean, it isn't that you ever misled us, but the feeling was you can't be that good about how to be healthy and all these kinds of things and not be. So how did that happen? Yeah. Where was the disconnect?
I did cook. I mean, we cooked probably more nights than we didn't, but I wasn't a very good cook, and I didn't give it much thought. It was one of, those subjects. There it is, cooking, big deal. What's there to say about it? It was really when I learned how important it was, both on the health side and on the environmental side, frankly. We're not going to change our food system if people insist on corporate cooked food, because corporations will buy food from the biggest monoculture mm-hmm. farms. So I did cook, but I cooked kind of thoughtlessly. And for me, the journey of discovery in this book was like getting better at it and learning what it's all about. And that it's a very profound transformation that we do, moving these things from nature to culture.
We want to talk about how you learned and the process you write about. But you mentioned the big agri-farms. A good friend of mine has been the head of FarmAid for mm-hmm. 25 years. And obviously talking about small family farmers. That's
good organization.
Is that... Where is that? In the Cambridges of the world where I live, in the Brooklines where Marjorie lives, in the Berkeleys where you live, I'm assuming it's center stage.
Yeah.
How center stage across America is that whole movement?
Well, there is a local food movement that's all over the country now. It's bigger in some places than others, but you can go to Iowa and you find, which is corn and soy land, which used to be a place, it was a food desert actually. There was no real food in Iowa. All the corn and soy was shipped out of state, processed into meat and fast food and sent back in. It was like a third world country. But now there's local food. There are people who are taking some of their acreage out of corn and soybeans and growing vegetables and selling them locally. So this is becoming a national movement. It's still small. It's got a long way to go. But it's got legs. And so I'm very encouraged by what I see going on. It's not just a coastal phenomenon. And it's not just an elite phenomenon. It's happening in inner cities as well.
We're talking with Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma and Cooking as well. So you touched on two things I think are a big problem. Mothers working very long hours and having no confidence in their abilities. So what do you tell the people that are listening right now that are in that boat? What should they do?
Well, I think a big problem with cooking was it was women's work. And it was a ghetto, basically. And it was denigrated as not being that important. And when women... entered the workforce, there was enormous tension over that in families, in my family. And there was this very charged, uncomfortable conversation between men and women about how do we divide how do we divide labor at home? There was cooking, there was childcare, there was cleaning. And as you know, it was very tense. And what happened with cooking is the industry, which had been trying to get in the American kitchen for 100 years, leapt forward and say, hey, stop arguing, we've got you covered. We'll cook for you. And it let men off the hook, and it let women off the hook, and we didn't finish that conversation. That's what we need to do now, because we need to get everybody in the kitchen, and most importantly, children. Because if they leave home without that critical life skill, I think it's irresponsible to let your kids graduate high school or college not knowing how to just roast a chicken, make 10 things, some tiny, simple repertoire. It's so important, and especially for boys. We need home ec again.
Yeah, we've talked about that a lot, about how to be great for boys and girls. You're an anti-microwave kind of guy, aren't you?
I love microwaves for reheating a cup of tea.
They are great at that.
And frozen things. It's great for that. Cooking in a microwave?
Awful.
Doesn't work.
So tell us what you did. You divide your thing into fire, water, what were the other two things?
Air and earth.
Okay.
The classical elements.
Okay, the fire thing, which because you dealt with some of the great barbecue masters of the world. Tell us a little bit. North Carolina, is that right? Tell us about this.
Well, fire is the first kind of cooking. It goes back 2 million years. It changed us as a species. It is the reason that we developed these big brains and small guts compared to other primates. It was a big deal in our evolution. So I wanted to find the existing most primal kind of cooking there is. And that turns out to be whole hog barbecue as practiced in Eastern North Carolina. Western North Carolina, they do pork shoulders. The barbecue Balkans, and it's highly divided all through the South. So I found a couple pit masters, one in particular named Ed Mitchell, who was in Raleigh at the time. Now he's in Durham. And he was cooking the way people have been cooking meat for hundreds of years. It's a 20-hour process, a lot of sitting around and drinking while it goes on. It grew out of the tobacco harvest in the South. It's what you did while you were letting, you had these fires to cure the tobacco. It was one of the few times that black and white sat down together to eat. And he said that in his experience, Ed Mitchell said that the two most integrated things in his life and the most profound things was Vietnam and barbecue. That's where the racial lines were crossed. And it remains one of the few places. I mean, even at the height of race tension in the South, if the good barbecue was at a black place, the whites would be there and vice versa.
So what can Mike Pollan do on the barbecue front that he couldn't do prior to his encounters with pitmasters?
Well, I learned, you know, for me, barbecuing, what I called barbecuing, was grilling things, you know, 5-10 minutes, hot temperature, take it on and take it off. What I learned is slowing down and cooking slowly over fire, you get amazing results. And so most of us cook way too hot. And so I learned to turn down the heat or let the coals, if I was using coals, burn all the way down. And then I put on the meat or whatever I was doing. And that kind of gentle cooking, I'm talking about 200 to 250 degrees. And you put it on and you leave it on most of the day. And you get the most sublime results.
We talked about how women, there's a sex divide. Women are braisers and men are grillers.
Yeah. Well, you know, grilling, I mean, the real secret of grilling that men don't let people in on is it's really easy. It's really A-B. Anybody can do it.
Yeah.
But we like to self-dramatize. And pit masters and even backyard barbecuers are always just kind of, they have their, you know, they're it's a show. And women are a little more, don't need that when they're cooking. And so they cook in pots where, of course, it's much less visible. It's very hard to make a big show about a stew the way, you know, you take a joint of meat and flames. And so that's why guys have always been into barbecue and will continue to be. They're also into baking, I found. That was another macho area of cooking that I learned about. And it tends to be male-dominated. Pastry chefs are women, but bread bakers are guys.
Really?
Yeah. Well, you know, think about it. You make this highly visible thing that gets much bigger as you cook. Enough said.
Okay.
So
okay.
Your current book, the book, it's out in paperback. It's called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. My advice for your next book is Bugged. And the reason this, we had a discussion the other day about how there is a bug movement, which you're probably aware of.
I am.
Much better for the environment, apparently. Much less use of water, those sort of things. Much higher protein content is a percentage
very sustainable
of the thing.
And
is that happening? I mean,
it's happening in a little way. There's a big taboo for us to get over. I have a student, actually, who just finished a great piece on crickets, and they're making energy bars out of crickets. And I tried them, and they're good, but the idea is a little gross. But we need to remember, especially here in New England, that lobsters were treated as bugs for 100 years, and people were really disgusted. In fact, there was a law in Massachusetts that you could only feed lobster to prisoners like 2 times a week because they wanted to do it every day. And it was considered brutal. So maybe we'll come around. Sushi, eating raw fish, is a taboo we overcame. You know, I'm not eager to do it, but yeah, it might be a good idea.
So what trends are on the horizon that either you'll be writing about or we'll be reading about in the New York Times or the Boston Globe or the Herald or something? What's next?
You know, I don't really have a crystal ball. You know, I think kale's moment has probably passed. And not a moment
too
soon.
Some of us missed it, yeah.
No, I mean, kale was fine, but we were eating too much of it. And I don't know what the next hot vegetable will be. You know, I come from Berkeley.
We're into Brussels sprouts here.
Well, I'm a big Brussels sprouts.
Oh, yeah. No, they're big.
They're big, yeah.
Yeah. So I don't really have a crystal ball.
You know,
I'm
Michael
sorry.
Pollan, in the back of your book, Cooked, you have a short shelf of books on cooking. If people are listening out here that want tips on how to take back the kitchen, learn how to cook some simple meals. Are there one or two that you could recommend?
You know, I really like Mark Bittman's books.
I mean, do too.
He's a good friend.
How to Cook Anything.
How to Cook Anything is, that's my go-to, and it simplifies things. He doesn't mystify. For example, the best thing I learned from Mark Bittman was rice. You can cook rice like pasta. You don't have to measure the water precisely. Just boil it in a ton of water, and when it tastes right, empty it into a colander. And I was like, oh, that takes a lot of anxiety out of rice cooking.
See, that causes me anxiety. It's the exact opposite.
I love that
If
book.
I can't measure it and I have to use I don't want to use judgment. And I know when you're a good cook, you have to use but that really, even you saying the words is anxiety provoking for me,
Michael. What's the hard part here?
Because you have to figure out when it's really right. If it turns out you follow the directions.
Well, one of the keys to cooking is tasting constantly.
Yes.
That is how you really learn to cook. At every stage, and you watch how things change, and you salt it a little bit and taste it before you salt it more. When I watch, I spend a lot of time in restaurant kitchens watching chefs, and that really is the key, tasting everything along the way. And if you do that, you know when it's ready.
Okay. So Mark Bittman, How to Cook Everything. Is there one more?
I think the Alice Waters books, The Art of Simple Eating, there are two volumes of that. It's very straightforward, and she's a wonderful cook.
And when you learn how to do it, you can do it much faster.
Yeah, I don't spend that much time cooking. I mean, maybe 30 minutes at night. And a couple of the ways I've dealt with time is I always make at least 50% more than we're going to eat. So I always
save
have
it.
Leftovers.
Yep.
We need to rebrand the leftover. I think leftovers are great. And that's one way. If you're going to cook, might as well make enough food for two meals.
Can we get back to the microwave thing for just one second? I know how, as a person who from time to time has done the microwave thing, I know how horrible. I read the contents. Is anybody working on a frozen meal that actually, I know there's whole food is not quite as bad, some of those, but why can't they breed, which is the wrong verb? For example, the sodium content is just absolutely, and I
out
assume that's a preservation thing. Isn't science ready to do something that's not going to kill us that reduces the sodium content in a frozen meal?
Food science may be able to make processed food better than it is now, and there's certainly a lot of work on salt and ways to increase the perception of salt with less salt by changing the molecular structure, and I hope they figure it out. But for now, those frozen meals are just salt bombs and fat bombs, and not to mention they don't taste very good. I mean, if you actually pay attention to how they taste, they all have good first bites. They've been engineered for the first bite, but the law of diminishing marginal utility sets in, and by the fifth bite, you're kind of disgusted.
Michael, where are you in the late, I was going to say late great Michael Bloomberg. He's not dead, but he's no longer the mayor. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
Whether
soda cups?
It's the 16-ounce thing.
Yeah.
He was also had a salt crusade, which I don't think went very far. What do you think about public initiatives on these fronts? Marjorie and I fight about them all the time.
I think we need to try them. I think, we have a serious problem in this country. The adult onset diabetes is now type 2 diabetes because kids are getting it now. There were no kids with this disease just in 1980.
And gluten intolerance,
And gluten intolerance is another problem. We need to experiment. We should try a soda tax somewhere. If it works, great. If it reduces soda consumption and rates of diabetes, great. And if it doesn't, throw it out. What Bloomberg was doing was the mildest kind of social engineering. This is nudge, politics.
Did you hear this,
right?
Marjorie? Nudge politics.
Which is non-coercive. And you're basically making tweaks to the environment to encourage people to think twice before they go to that second 16 ounces. I think Bloomberg made a mistake in the way he introduced it. He should have been talking about children. You can't make that nanny state argument about kids. Kids need nannies.
Michael Pollan is a journalist and a best-selling author. His latest book, which is now in paperback, is Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. When we come back, we'll look at how the way we eat, rather than what we eat, can make our food tastier and more enjoyable. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're hitting the rewind button, playing conversations about how we eat and what we eat and traditions associated with food. We continue the conversation with behavioral economist Michael Norton. Emily Rooney and Marjorie Egan sat down with him earlier this year.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Emily Rooney is sitting in for Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. So, when you eat a piece of pie, do you save the crust for last? Absolutely. Do you shine your apple before taking the first bite? No, I don't, but I cut it in pieces because I like to bite into the flesh instead of into the skin. What about symmetry? Does your food have to be arranged a certain way on your plate before you dig into your meal? If you have to eat something in a certain way, it's not a neurotic tic like you may have thought. Researchers have actually found that simple rituals can enhance the enjoyment of what you eat. And the results of this study were published recently online in Psychological Science. Michael Norton worked on this study. He's at the Harvard Business School, and he's a co-author of Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. Michael Norton, welcome back.
Good to be back. So we're going to be taking some calls on this.
We're going to take some
calls
on this, too.
We want to hear everybody's crazy food rituals. Great.
So tell us, I think this is a common one, right?
Yeah.
Do you eat the inside of the Oreo cookie first?
I definitely have some rituals, but my number one ritual is I don't just eat for the sake of eating, though. I mean, I have to have something that's really good or I don't bother. I mean, that's why every day I walk into the cafeteria, to me, there's nothing to eat there. I'd rather have a bag of potato chips. So that's number one. So I'm very picky about what I eat. That's a ritual in itself, you know, like.
Well, Michael, was this surprising? Was this surprising? Did you find that you were shocked to learn that people eat the inside of the Oreo cookies first?
We knew that from just chatting with people that almost everyone has some kind of food ritual with at least one kind of food that they eat. And, of course, in everyday life, we use rituals all the time. Anytime there's a sports team playing, people do crazy rituals. So we know that people really like to engage in rituals across all sorts of things. And we saw lots of funny ones with food. But we didn't know if they would actually really enhance the experience or not. So people might have thought, if I do this, it's going to taste much better. But we didn't know if it really would. And that's why we did some research to say, how and why does doing these strange things and cutting it in this way actually make the apple taste better?
Yeah, tell them about the candy bar experiment.
So the simplest one we did was literally just took a regular Hershey's candy bar. Those are nice because they come in little squares.
They do.
And they're fun to break apart, actually, especially I was going to say for little kids, but I like to do it too.
Me too. Square at a time.
Exactly. And all we told people to do was either just eat the candy bar or break it in a certain way. So we said break it in half and then unwrap some and then break it again and then unwrap some and then break it again and then unwrap some. Basically how we eat it in general, but that really systematic, ritualized way of eating it. When we asked people how good was the chocolate, it actually tasted better to them than when they just ate it the regular way. Something about that elaborate process really made the chocolate better.
So what's the science? Why does this happen?
It looks like from the data that we have is often when we eat, we're pretty mindless about it. So we're watching TV or we're talking to somebody else and we just sort of eat food and we don't think much about it. And when people engage in these rituals, one of the things it does is it really involves you in the experience. And we know from lots of things that it's good to be involved in the experience. So if you watch a movie and you're distracted, there's no way you're going to enjoy it as much as if you're really deeply into it. Rituals seem to focus us on what we're doing, and that way every single piece of chocolate tastes better. In fact, we even show that people take longer to eat the chocolate, like they're savoring every bite because they're so involved in the moment.
Our number is 877-301-8970. If you'd like to discuss your food rituals with Michael Norton and find out if they're weird neurotic tics or if they're just ways to make you enjoy the food more. Now, I think a classic one, and you talked about this in the piece, was the crust off crust off sandwiches.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, when I have a grilled cheese sandwich, I eat the crust around it first, or I cut it in four so that I can bite into the juicy melted cheese part first. I mean, I'm getting hungry even talking about this.
My favorite part is the crust, though.
Yeah. You like the crust best? I like the crust
anything
least.
Anything burnt or charred.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys should share sandwiches and split them every time. It's perfect.
I like the crust. I like the inside, the gooey part. Yeah. I mean, that's a great one. It talked about what I found really weird, though, this carrot ritual, because who gets excited about eating baby carrots? I mean, I just can't get excited about that. But tell people about that one.
Yeah, we thought, you know, maybe it's easy to get excited about chocolate or about wine or about these other really nice foods. And we said, I wonder if we can even make something really boring and really not emotional better by making it a ritual. And we thought, let's use a really, really boring food, which is carrots. Mm-hmm. So can we actually, by having people eat carrots in a more ritualistic way, make them taste as good as when they eat chocolate in a ritualistic way? And we have them do, again, sort of silly rituals like knocking on a table 3 times and then eating the carrot. And the more they knock on the table, the longer we have them do that, the more they like the carrot. It's crazy. But it seems to be the case that when people do rituals before they eat, something kicks in, something triggers us, we're involved in the experience, and then the carrot actually tastes better.
Now, I tried this with my corn muffin upstairs before I came down.
How did it work?
Corn muffins. I knocked on the table 3 times. I wasn't sure it tasted it. I find that one hard to believe, but you said you had, 52 kids that you studied, and this was true with these kids.
One of the things that we're really trying to do with these rituals ideas is, of course, all of us are trying to build healthy habits. And it's very hard to get excited about eating carrots. Mm-hmm. It's pretty easy to get excited about eating chocolate or a grilled cheese sandwich. It's hard to get excited about eating carrots. We're trying to see if we can use the interesting nature of rituals on boring, healthy food to build that into a habit. So carrots aren't just carrots anymore. There's something interesting that you might eat. And maybe that will lead us in the future to eat more healthy food.
What about getting people to do more presentation with their food? Is that part of it? So, I mean, some people are just right out of the package. Or they'll put a microwave frozen dinner and just eat it right out of the thing, as opposed to giving themselves a presentation or spending. Is that part of it too?
It is, I think. In fact, we have some other research on what we call the IKEA effect. And the idea there was actually when you make things yourself, you come to really like them more, whether it's food or putting a bookshelf together. it turns out that putting effort into things, that alone can really make you like them more, including food. And then over and above that, it seems something about the ritualistic nature of putting yourself into things makes them even better. So I think you're right. Both of those things, which we very rarely do. Usually, as you said, we just eat things out of a box. But doing both of those things really makes things much more enjoyable.
Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. We're talking with Michael Norton, who did this fantastic – I mean, this is just an amazing study to me because it makes so much sense.
It does.
about how rituals – a ritualistic way or eating – with little rituals, whether it's cutting off the crust or cutting the nectarine, which I also do with a knife before I eat it, or having your eggs a certain way, which is another one. You know, if they're not flipped over right, so you can't like pierce the bread and the knife and have all the yolk come out. Yeah, okay. It's not as good. So tell us about your rituals. What do you think about this study? 877-301-8970, or our email address is bpr@wgbh.org. Michael, you talked about, too, the watching the ritual as opposed to participating in the ritual with opening bottles of wine. Tell people about that.
Yeah, so we wondered if it's maybe just sort of seeing a ritual at all might be the thing that really makes you happier. So if you see someone in a restaurant doing a lot, you know, have a sommelier who opens the wine in an elaborate way, and that probably does actually increase the experience, you know, how interesting it is.
Yeah.
But we wanted to see if you do it yourself, is it even better? And it turns out the answer is yes. So if you watch somebody knocking on the table, that's okay and doesn't really make that much of a difference. It's when you do the ritual yourself is when it really starts to hit you. I think about it actually sometimes, speaking of cutting crusts off, a lot of kids have food rituals.
Yes,
but they don't actually
do
themselves.
Their parents do it
For them. So your mom or dad has to cut all the edges off the crust.
Yeah.
And that probably actually does make it better. In fact, many of our grown-up rituals that we have with food are a memory of how we used to like it when we were little
kids.
That's
how crust got a bad name.
Exactly.
It's crazy. Crust is the best part.
So if you're arranging all the M&Ms in different colors, this doesn't mean you have an OCD problem. Because, you know, I mean, you do see that sometimes with your children. You're worrying, should I be concerned that little Johnny has got all the chocolate ones there and the red ones there and the yellow ones there, and he can't eat them, you know, unless they're in that order. We don't have to necessarily go to the therapist to discuss that.
My guess is if he's doing it for 5 minutes and then eating them, you're probably fine. If he does it for 5 days, you probably might have a problem.
But the phones are lighting up. I think we're not the only ones with food rituals here, Marjorie.
877-301-8970. Let's take a call, Emily.
All right. Let's go to Kurt from Hudson.
Hi there.
Hey,
hi, Kurt.
Kurt.
What's your deal?
I love to eat burgers around the edge because you capture all the stuff as it's starting to fall out, and then your fingers, as they go around, keep all the really good stuff in the middle. So the last bite is always the best one because you've eaten around the edges of the burger, and everything, the pickle, everything that's in the center is still there at the last bite. It really works.
That's a good one.
Do you do that in public, Kurt, when you go to a restaurant?
All the time.
Really?
I never even thought about it until a girlfriend mentioned it once. She was like, you know, why do you do that?
I was going to ask if you do that on first dates.
Did you get her into it?
No. Nobody else has picked it up for me, actually. It's kind of weird.
Well, that's a good – thank you for the call, Kurt. That reminds me of something I would only do in private. You know, if I'm eating – I might do it with my kids, but I would never do it out in public. If you have turkey and mashed potatoes and peas and gravy, and I kind of mash them all together in this big thing in the middle of my plate and eat it that way, it tastes better. But that's sort of – embarrassing to do in public. Do you have any rituals that you do that in the privacy of your own home you wouldn't do in public, Michael Norton?
Food related or in general?
Well, I mean, if you'd like to make any confessions here, we're ready to hear them. But we were speaking about food.
I am not a huge ritualistic person, actually, although I do, mainly because it's because I'm a terrible cook, but I do have one dish that I make that I have a special system of timing it exactly right. So the water has to boil for this long and then the pasta has to be in for exactly this long. And when other people make it, and we often see this is how you know something's a ritual, if other people make it in kind of the same way, but maybe they do something for a little bit shorter or a little bit longer, it really ruins it for you. And that's how you know you have a ritual. If you're bugged by the way someone's making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, you've got a ritual in the way you make them, and you can identify them in yourself.
So your thing is al dente pasta. It has to be a certain okay.
Exactly.
Okay. I like that.
877-301-8970. Let's go to Jennifer from Cambridge. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. Great fan of the show. I mean, I'm a fan of your great show.
Thank you.
My
So my husband, I try to be polite about it, but it drives me nuts when he stands in the middle of the kitchen and just pops the chocolate-covered almonds into his mouth while looking at the TV. And he argues that that's no different than when I put them in this one little square dish that I have and sit down and eat them like mouse. Not that I'm a, you know, modest eater, but I think it makes it more enjoyable and makes it less likely that I'm going to overeat.
Yeah.
And he argues that's ridiculous. It's no different. They both go in your face, and what difference does it make?
What do you think, Michael?
Well, one is a lot more casual, for sure.
I think that's right. In fact, there is a way of thinking about rituals as helping you with portion control in some sense, where you the longer you take to eat something, the less of it you're likely to eat. And so you may be on a good strategy where, even though it might seem like a waste of time to your husband that you take it from one container and put it in another container and then eat it, you're probably helping yourself eat less, whereas your husband standing and taking handfuls and eating it down might actually be helping him to overeat.
We have a sarcastic email from Stephen, but I'm going to read it because it's kind of funny.
What does he say?
He says he has a ritual of voting for nanny state elected officials before eating low-fat, low-salt, sugar-free foods, although it doesn't seem to help. I presume that might be a reference to the mayor of New York City who's trying to guard all the way we eat everything.
Well, we've had a few of those here, too.
Yeah, we've had a few of those here, too.
All right, calls are coming in here. Let's see. How about Mike from Milford? You there, Mike?
Hello?
Go ahead.
Hey, I get picked on a lot because I eat one thing at a time.
So like, you have a whole plate.
That's weird, but yeah.
Like a turkey, a Thanksgiving dinner, you'll eat the turkey and then the squash and then the mash.
Right.
In everything or just a certain thing? I mean, give us an example here.
Most everything. Yeah, most everything.
So you eat all the peas before you move on to the meat?
Yeah, if you have French fries with a... You know, with something, I have the fries first and then the sandwich or, you know, like you said, at Thanksgiving dinner, that kind of a thing. It just, I'm ordered, I guess, in my thoughts.
Yeah.
Mike,
makes sense to me.
Mike, if the things touch each other, does even that upset you? Or can they touch each other but you still have to eat them separately?
It used to when I was a kid. They could not touch. I've gotten better with that.
Good question.
Because you've had some personal growth over your life. They can touch, but you can't eat them together yet.
Yeah. Now, Michael,
yeah.
do you feel this has caused a problem in your life?
No.
Or do you feel this
doesn't bother me at all?
It doesn't bother you at all. How about your family or your spouse or whatever?
No, people just pick on me or not.
Okay. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I would not do this, some of these things. I mean, if I went out and ordered 2 eggs over easy and they came back and one of them, you know, the yolk was punctured, I would not send it back and demand. But at home, I will. Because I would be embarrassed in public. How about you, Emily? Would you do? I mean, some of these things seem a little weird to do out at a restaurant or with friends.
Well, it depends on what it is. I mean, I think a lot of things people don't really notice. Like, although Michael's thing, I think I would notice if somebody ate.
Yeah, I would.
All the French fries first, but I think a lot of these things, like the way you cut things, the way you cut meat, the way you know, if it's a steak, what part of it you eat first. I think. You know it in mm-hmm. your head, but I think it would go largely unnoticed by table mates.
Is it a ritual to spear the peas with the fork? or
do you,
not?
Do you have to do that in order to enjoy them, or do you like to do it?
Well, you don't want to leave them. It's hard to capture them, you know. You can spear them, or you can kind of push them onto your fork with your knife. I'm not sure what Miss Manners says about the exact correct way to do it. I'm not sure. But, you know, I like peas. I want to get them all, especially if they've got tons of butter and salt on them.
But that's kind of different, isn't it? Manners and protocol versus ritual. And,
well,
and I agree that sometimes they kind of cross over, because one ritual can actually be sort of obnoxious habit that could be upsetting to other people.
Yeah, okay. So the reason you're doing this is to help people with their weight control or with their whatever. Why are you doing this? What is the purpose going to be used for?
I think two things. One is just helping us enjoy what we eat more, mm-hmm. which I think is a lot of the research that we do on happiness is really trying to think of ways that people can be happier in their everyday lives, whether it's with food or friends or whatever, you know, how you live, can you make the same thing happier from day to day? But you're absolutely right. The other thing with food in particular is, can we help people by having them engage in rituals, which are fun and interesting, maybe slow down how quickly they eat, mm-hmm. maybe help them enjoy their food more. And now we're really looking to see, can we help them start to eat healthier as we talked about, if we make the boring food more interesting, and then you're more likely to come back and have more of it.
The number's 877-301-8970. Take some calls here.
Yeah, let's go to Judith in Newton because she's kind of buying right into what we're talking about here. Go ahead, Judith.
Hi. Well, first thing is that the French, who know more about food than anybody, have an expression, first you eat with your eyes. And I think they totally know what they're talking about. For example, when you buy cheese or meat at a deli counter, if you have it sliced thin, it tastes a whole lot better, even if you eat the same amount. And when you look at the pre-sliced piles, you know, I mean, that's just totally disgusting when they pick up a bunch of that. But if it's individually sliced and wrapped, it's just more, it's more appealing.
That is true. I don't like to see big slabs of things. That's a great point, don't you think? Don't you get things thinly sliced at the deli?
Yeah, thinly sliced.
Yeah, and then you feel like it lasts longer.
Yeah.
Well, they don't like you. They like you to buy the pre-slice because it saves them time, and they don't like you to ask to have it customized. But I do it anyway because I know the cheese, for example, is going to taste a whole lot better.
That's right. You can't let these deli people work the way
around. Most of them do it right.
You have to put your foot down. Thank you for the call.
Yeah, good one.
You have to go up. Well, Whole Foods. I mean, if you go to Whole Foods because you're into the non-preserved meat, you can get the stuff that's hanging on the shelves in the plastic, which, you know, is totally unappealing to me. Or you can go and wait, and they are really slow. You can go and
they are really slow.
But you can go and wait 10 minutes, or, you know, to get
or make your order and then you disappear and come back and get it.
Now, here's a good question. This is emailed in. Your guest, that would be Michael Norton, of course, has research that shows ritual makes food more tasty. I want to know how to leverage this with kids who are non-compliant with green food, and also address the problem of when a child's food ritual crosses the threshold of playing with your food. Good questions.
Actually, the last caller made me think about, there's a recent book, and I've forgotten. I'm pretty sure it's called it's either Why French People Eat Anything or Why French Children Eat Anything. but either way, a bunch of the book is about kids, and it is the case, in fact, that in France, children eat more vegetables than in the United States.
They do?
And there's probably lots of...
They know how to cook them.
Well, that's actually part of what the book is about, is that the... French do have more elaborate kind of cooking rituals and serving rituals, and maybe kids get a little bit confused about what's the fun food if everything seems fun, and they might actually eat more leafy greens and the things that we really want them to eat. So I think cross-culturally, if you think about what are the cultures that seem to be better at getting kids to eat the good stuff than other cultures, maybe we can learn something from how they get it done.
I know you got to get going, Michael, in a minute, but we've got to take this one call because this is a ritual. All right. Katia, I think it is. Boston, go ahead.
Hi, this is Katia. I was calling to say I eat my food, round food, like M&Ms or blueberries, in even numbers. So I'll put one on one side of my mouth, one on the other.
I think I do that, too.
Okay, Katia.
I'm glad I'm not alone, Emily.
Yeah, I think I do that.
Now, have you found this to be a problem in your life, Katia, or is it okay?
Say that again?
Has this been a problem for you, or is this okay?
No, it's okay. I can adjust in normal life, but I do it.
What do you do if you've got only one M&M left? You throw it out?
I bite it in half.
Oh, she had the answer.
I love that.
Yeah,
I love
that,
Connie. Thank you for the call. Michael, though, the email I was getting to this point, and maybe there is a ritual about this, about can you make a ritual around broccoli? Can you make a ritual around green beans to make little kids excited about eating them?
I think you can. And in fact, if you think about the ways that parents try to get kids to eat vegetables now, they often do turn it into something else. You know, so the plane coming in for a landing is, of course, the most classic one. And the kid opens his mouth and you try to get the lima beans in there. So we are thinking about ways to have more effective rituals for parents to get their kids involved with the green beans, and then suddenly the kid finds themselves liking them more.
Yeah, the broccoli, the tree. That's always, it's a little tree, and here's the tree. Yes. It's going to make you very healthy. And the other thing is, you really can't dunk your cookies or your donuts in public either, I don't think. Although
yes,
you can. You go to someone's house for dessert and dunk your cookie in your coffee.
I would.
I can't
say I've done it recently, but I would.
Do you do that, Michael?
I don't have any friends, so I never had that experience. Sounds great.
All right.
Okay, can we squeeze in one more call here before you go? Amy from Little Compton. Go ahead, Amy.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
I had a question. We all were talking about you know, cutting the crust off or eating the crust first or eating the gooey center of the grilled cheese first. And I was just wondering if you had studied at all what it means of, you know, having the good stuff first or putting it off for last.
That's a good one.
Yes, there's actually very interesting research. So the phrase to remember is the peak end rule. And what that means is if you have some experience in your life and then a week later I ask you how much did you like that experience, what you will remember is the very best moment and the very last moment of that experience, and you forget almost everything else. So it's really, really important when you're eating to try to get an amazing moment and also to end on a high note. So people who do, in fact, save the best bite for last are making a wise decision because you remember the last bite often more than any of the other bites that you eat. And if I ask you a week later, how was that meal? If you end on a sour note, you'll think the meal wasn't great. Mm. But if you end on a high note, you'll think it was.
We were talking with Michael Norton, a behavioral economist at Harvard Business School and co-author of the book Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. When we come back, we'll look at the art form and design of something many of us probably overlook, and that's the form and function of the pizza box. Stay tuned for that conversation. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Today we're looking through our archives and pulling out some of our favorite conversations over the year. One of those was with a man who is fixated on pizza, on everything from the crust to the cardboard box that they come in. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. As I just said to our next guest, when you order a pizza, chances are you're too focused on what's inside the box rather than the box itself. But that is not the case for Scott Wiener. Scott is obsessed with the entire package. Literally, his new book, which is really fun, is Viva La Pizza, The Art of the Pizza Box. You can catch him tonight at a book and pizza event at Otto Pizza. That's on Commonwealth Avenue. More about that a little bit later. Scott, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're so thrilled that you're here. But I must admit, until I saw your terrific book, Viva La Pizza, it never occurred to me that there's like as many pizza boxes as there are pizzas. And you have sort of documented all these different pizza boxes in your book. How did you get to this place?
Well, it's, you know, it's funny. Your reaction to it is exactly why I wrote this book and why it has to exist. It's I started collecting pizza boxes around 2008, early 2009, right around the time that I started my business, which is called Scott's Pizza Tours, where I take people around New York City and kind of do a guided tour of famous pizzerias.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, the whole thing. And I get people from all over the world. And as I started noticing pizza boxes in my travels, I would say to somebody who was from Ireland, I would say, oh, well, hey, I don't have any Irish pizza boxes. Can you send me some? And then I started getting tons. And now I've got 45 countries covered. I've got over 600 boxes. Just last week, I got the Guinness World Record for largest pizza box collection.
We saw the video in your apartment in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Bedford Stuyvesant. Of how many pizza boxes do you have in there?
Now I have over 600.
You know, Scott, when I saw that video and I read about you for the first time, the moment that I really want to focus on with you, the moment where you had to decide, will I lead pizza tours or be a surgeon? What was that moment? How did you, in all seriousness, so you say to yourself, I'm going to lead pizza tours and start collecting pizza boxes? What epiphany, what happened that caused you to make that decision?
Well, it was funny. You know, I liked going to eat at pizzerias just as any normal human does. Mm-hmm. But in college and after college, I was playing in rock bands. And we would travel around.
What city? Where's this?
Yeah, pardon me?
Where were you doing this?
All over the country.
Okay.
I would book our tours and we'd play everywhere, anywhere somebody would let us play. And every day we'd get into a city, check out local pizza, play a show, check out more pizza, just because it was sort of something fun to do. So as we were traveling around, I got really into pizza. When I got back home, it became every weekend I'd take friends to different pizzerias. And that just transformed into taking their friends, which transformed again into doing it as a business.
Okay, so let's get to the box itself. What are the criteria that cause you to say this is a fine pizza box? And what are the criteria which cause you to say no thought went into this at all? What is it?
Well, at first I was interested in getting boxes that said on the box where it was from, just so I could sort of, you know, start to, as you collect more, you start to see that there's a correlation between the artwork and maybe even the product on the inside.
Meaning
or the
no generics.
Itself.
You're not into the
well,
generics.
At first, I was not into generics.
Okay.
Then my collection totally shifted into being almost the majority of which is generics, because I find that now it's more interesting as I'm getting boxes from Kazakhstan and Bolivia. I mean, I've got boxes from everywhere. And you start to see sort of what's the thought process behind the artwork and what's their attitude toward the food in that country. So I have some box motifs that I have representatives from different countries. Like in the book, there's a section about the proud chef motif. Pizza maker holding a pizza in front of a brick oven with a fire in the oven. And I have that from all these different countries. And you see the chef looks different. And then you see, oh, he looks kind of like those people do. And the pizza's different and the color.
Don't you write that the chef is winking a lot in these boxes?
Well, everybody knows
that. What is that about?
Well, you know, it's funny. I traced it back to burger joints in the mid-1950s, like burger joints, especially in Los Angeles, that used this sort of winking chef, which you didn't have anywhere in pizza imagery until you needed pizza imagery, which is when pizza starts being delivered to homes. It was always something that you go out to, and then once it's being delivered to homes, you need printed material, and printed collateral is really only starts up in the late 50s.
We're talking with Scott Wiener. His new book is Viva la Pizza, and it is a collection of all these unbelievably gorgeous, some not so gorgeous, pizza boxes from all over the world. So I want to know, is the Bolivian pizza box or the pizza box from Kazakhstan, are they distinctive? Are they different from American pizza boxes? Or do people make them always from cardboard? Or what's, you know, how do they vary throughout the world?
So as far as material is concerned, it's almost always either cardboard or corrugated board.
Okay.
But the thickness or thinness of the corrugation base is dependent on the country. So in the United States, we have very thick corrugated. We use what they call beef flute, which is sort of a thick, strong corrugation. But in other countries like Italy, where the pizzas are thinner, smaller, and lighter, they use a much smaller corrugation, which is not as strong. So the box itself has a lot to do with it. Now, as far as color is concerned, America is all about two colors. 90% of our boxes are two colors, and it's usually red and green. When you go to Israel, I see a lot of yellow and blue. Kazakhstan was a lot of blue and red. I mean, every different country's got a ton. In Italy, it's four-color process printing, which is gorgeous. It's the images in the book that looked most like paintings, which are paintings, actually. Those are the incredible ones that we do not have here.
You have this season's greetings one, which is absolutely gorgeous. It's got houses and snow and people on carriages and beautiful churches. I mean, this is unbelievable. Who did this?
That was printed real close in Wakefield, Massachusetts.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah, that's a Rock 10 box, which is the largest box producer in the United States. And that was printed in 1998, and it won an award in Germany, a Flexography Award.
You can take the pizza out of here and put this above your mantle in the living room.
Let me
Jen,
tell you,
that's
I'm giving, by the way, I'm giving you that box for Christmas.
Thank
it's
you very
funny
much.
You should say. Hey, Scott Wiener, is there a direct connection between the thought that goes into the box and the thought that goes into the pizza? I would like to believe that the better and more creative the box, the better and more creative the pizza. My guess is that doesn't work. Is that a fair assumption?
You know, I hate to generalize, but usually it's the inverse. Usually
really?
I find that in New York, I live in New York, I'm from the New York area, and the pizza is so good, and they put no thought into the boxes. They're all generic, very few custom boxes. But then I find that places that put a lot of effort into the box, sometimes it's not It's not. It's the funds have been diverted there and not maybe not the pizza.
You know, you got us to both thinking about things that we had never thought about before today, which neither of us are very happy about. But one of the things, Scott Wiener, is pizza ever packaged in something other than a box? I mean, I assume the box obviously makes sense because the stuff on top, and if you have obviously put some wrap on it, the stuff is going to stick to the wrap. But do any countries, any part of the United States, any part of the world package a pizza or offer a pizza? I don't mean frozen, obviously, in something other than a corrugated or a variation on the theme box?
Well, there are some real old school places that will package, that will slide the pizza onto a corrugated circle and slip that into a paper bag because it does a better job of not trapping steam and not creating a soggy crust. The box is sort of there so that you can support other pizzas.
Yeah.
The box, that corrugated box is all because of Domino's. Really, Tom Monahan from Domino's is the guy who's basically responsible for putting that corrugation in the box industry. But then other countries try other things. Like I get a bunch of – because of all these videos I put up on YouTube, I get people sending me prototypes. I got an inflatable pizza box from – I don't remember where it was from. But maybe Denmark. I think it was from Denmark. An inflatable pizza box, which is kind of funny. A bunch of different pizza bags, you know, funky, weird things that haven't taken off, and it's because they're expensive to produce and they don't have the support for stacking. Because pizza is unfortunately thought of as being a fast food, and a fast food is something that people want to have a lot of.
By the way, if you have a question for Scott or a suggestion as to a box he may not have discovered in New England,
I don't think
you can give him
one.
A quick call at 877-301-8970. We are actually discussing pizza boxes right here on Boston
Public
Radio.
Well, because I'm suddenly now fascinated by pizza boxes.
I never
knew what I was missing until today. So in your apartment in Brooklyn, how big is your apartment in Brooklyn?
So it's a two-bedroom apartment.
Two-bedroom apartment.
And it's not very large. It's in Bed-Stuy, which is a kind of roomier area than other areas.
Yeah.
But all the boxes, they're not set up. They're flattened down. Because boxes come to the pizzeria flattened in what they call blanks. They're all flattened down and they're compressed and they're in the top half of one closet.
Okay. So it's not like in the video we saw you where there were like 5 foot high stacks of pizza boxes all over your apartment.
Yeah. Every time I get a call from someone who wants to do a video or a photo, I have to bring out 150 boxes, stack them up, make it look like I'm insane, and then we do a funny video.
Okay.
But then they go back. Like actually before I got on a train to come up here, we did a quick photo. And then everything was in the closet before I left because I did not want to keep it a disaster there.
Okay,
well, actually, I was a former housing lawyer in the South Bronx. Do you know who the Collier sisters were?
I don't.
As a New York City
hoarders,
kid?
Hoarders, weren't they?
They were hoarders. The Collier sister, they're called Collier's Mansions, were two sisters about 100 years ago who saved and collected everything, sort of like you, Scott, I should say. But the difference is they didn't collapse things and put them in the closet. And as a result, when they're hoarders in apartments in New York City and there's a move to evict them, it's called a Collier's Mansion eviction. But apparently you're safe. Go ahead.
I have another question about these pizza boxes. I mean, usually when you get the pizza box out, there's like the cheese is left and the olive oil and stuff like that. So do you have to scour these pizza boxes, or are you just risking the
rodents that may get into
your apartment?
I'm really glad that I can put this on record and clarify that the boxes that I have, about 90% of them are completely unused.
Okay. That's
because
good.
A lot of them I get from their manufacturers or I get from pizzerias without the pizza in them. The other 10%, sometimes people send me boxes from China or some from Japan, and they are beautiful, but then I open it up and I see that there's a little bit of grease or cheese. What I do is I remove the cheese and I put a little polyurethane coat on it so that it's not disgusting.
Wait. Have you ever eaten the cheese or licked the bottom of the box? Tell the truth, Scott.
I don't want to answer that question.
I know you wouldn't. Let's take a call. Russ, you're in the car. You are talking to Scott Wiener, who's written this great new book, Viva La Pizza, The Art of the Pizza Box. Hey there, Russ.
Hi, I have to go out and get this book for my wife for Christmas. I got a story to tell. My wife and I were in Florence, Italy this summer, celebrating our anniversary. And one night I saw this pizza box, and I told my wife, I should have got that for lunch. But, I always have buyer's remorse when you're eating food. I'm Italian. But anyway, I said, we have to get some of that pizza before we leave town. So I kept seeing the same pizza box showing up all over Florence. And so I told my wife, I said, wow, that pizza place must be pretty good. And she said, you're an idiot. That's the same. It's a generic pizza box. So our last night, I went to this pizza place and I said, I just want to get a pizza so I can take this pizza box home. And lo and behold, it was a different pizza box. So I was saved by one pizzeria, and it's a beautiful pizza box that's now sitting in our kitchen
and a symbol of not my stupidity.
Can I tell you, that's one of the most beautiful stories I've ever heard, Russ.
It is. It's very romantic.
That is a beautiful anniversary. Happy anniversary retroactively to you and your wife, Russ. Thank you for the call.
We have an email from Keith. He wants to know, and I don't know about this, but maybe you do, Scott. He wants to know what you think about the Domino's pizza worker making boxes at 100 miles per hour in the commercial.
So that's accurate, by the way. I mean, these Domino's guys are fast, but I got to clarify that the Domino's box that they're using is different from standard pizza boxes you find around the rest of the country at non-Domino's places. It's a very specific patent. It's featured in the book. There's a sort of section in the book about the technology of different pizza boxes.
Yep.
And the corners are cut off, which means they use less paper, and they're designed to be faster to fold.
Okay, I've got a bunch of questions for you. One, what else did you collect as a kid? I'm serious. What did you collect?
The only other thing I've ever really collected were the tabs on the top of soda cans.
Oh my God, that is pathetic.
But okay, then, secondly, thank you very much.
Okay, I'm not done.
Okay,
I got a bunch of questions here.
Well, I want to get in one myself.
Where does pizza? The conventional wisdom is it's Italian. A lot of people think it's from China. Where is pizza originally from?
Not at all from China. But, I mean, you have to think about what is pizza. It's a wheat flour-based dough that's baked into a crust with a topping of usually tomato and then cheese.
Yeah.
All those ingredients, none of them are from China.
So is Italy the deal?
Italy is absolutely the deal, but it's an Italian variation on a Mediterranean flatbread idea, the concept of taking old dough, flattening it down, and using it to remove heat from the floor of an oven that's too hot. So that really comes from Greece, which then, you know, ends up becoming what we know of as pizza in southern Italy.
So on your pizza tours, are there one or two places you can tell people that they should not miss if they're going to the Big Apple?
That is so difficult. I mean, it all depends because, there's so many pizzerias in all the boroughs, and we have a bank of about 30 pizzerias that I pull from. So on every tour, it could be a different combination.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, Lombardi's was the first pizzeria in the United States. But then there's Sam's in Brooklyn that always gets overlooked.
Yeah.
And then there's Totono's in Coney Island that people just don't get all the way out to. So, I mean, there's just so many amazing places. I have a list at scottspizzatours.com/pizzerias.
Okay.
I just got a list of all the places.
Have you spent any time eating pizza in Boston or in greater Boston?
Oh, yeah, actually.
So what's on the list here?
Oh, well, I had
both in terms of boxes and the contents.
Boxes, I got to say, not that high on my list in
except
Boston.
Except that Christmas thing in wherever you just
right,
said, Wakefield.
The one that was printed in Wakefield. But actually, in the book, we do have a Regina box.
Yes, I saw the Regina box.
Yeah, because of the amount of text. I just
with
came
all
from
the
Regina.
Writing.
I was there about 20 minutes ago. I like Regina a lot, but my favorite is Galleria Umberto.
Where is that?
That's the one right in the North End. It's a couple of blocks from Regina. It's that.
Really?
It's this little Sicilian place with arancini and bakery style pizza. And it's just the line forms and they run out by 2 o'clock. And it's just like I went there at 10 this morning just to make sure to get it.
So is there a future in this for you? I mean, I'm sorry to keep focusing. I don't want to be your mother, Scott.
Well, what does mom think?
Mom loves it. Are you kidding me? Mom loves it.
Good.
My parents bring me back boxes from everywhere.
Okay.
It's just that, you know, I run this pizza tour company. It's like a real thing. It's legitimate. It's accredited.
It's a real thing.
And then, you know, collecting these pizza boxes seems kind of insane, but there's a purpose to it. And my apartment is not covered in disgusting pizza boxes.
So if we're in New York City, scottspizzatours.com, .whatever.
.com.
Okay. And when you go to these, the selection of some of the 30 pizzerias that you were part of your tour, do people sample them at these joints? What do they do?
Oh, yeah. We go in the kitchen. We check out the oven. We get a slice. And then after each slice, we discuss, we break down piece by piece how each part of the pizza works. So if the crust is crunchy, I explain why. Because of the amount of water, because of the way that the dough is open, because of the baking style. By the time the tour's done, you know what oven each slice came from just by looking at it.
Oh, my God. I'm going to get my kids this for Christmas. They both live in New York.
Get me this for Christmas.
I mean, really, and it's funny because everyone on the tour asked me, oh, well, where's your book? Have you written a book? And now when I can tell them, yeah, I do, but it's only about the box, they just crack up. It's exactly what
Scott Wiener, great book, great business. Scott, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Scott's book is Viva la Pizza, The Art of the Pizza Box. You really need to go to his website where you can see photos of some of his favorite pizza boxes. That's at scottspizzatours.com. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Our production crew is Chelsea Murs, Will Roslip, and Amanda McGowan. Alan Mattis and John Parker are our engineers. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio.